David Livingstone is my name, and I'm the author of five books on the history of the occult. I can start with The Dying God is the first one, which is going to be which is largely treating the subject that we're planning to talk about tonight. It's basically the history of the cult, tracing the history of the cult as far back as I could to at least ancient Babylon and following it to the French Revolution. Then I wrote Terrorism Illuminati. Black Terror, White Soldiers, Transhumanism, the History of a Dangerous Idea, and most recently, which is Order Ab Cow, which is a six-volume set.
Well, if you don't mind me just picking up on one word, a sort of trigger word you say there, the Illuminati, terrorism and the Illuminati. I mean, most people they see this as a kind of crazy conspiracy idea, which has been made popular in things like card games and by Robert Anton Wilson in his kind of spoof books, but that there's really nothing to this.
Right. Well, there's two ways that you can view the term. So the reality is that there was a group, a secret society formed in 1776 by a former Jesuit named Adam Weishaupt, German pronunciation, and whose goals was effectively something in the lines of, some kind of New World Order. So what happened is that it was banned in Germany, in Bavaria in particular, in 1785, I believe, 1786, 77. And so for that reason, mainstream scholars have been leaning towards the theory that they stopped existing. It's a well-known fact that, in his own words, Weishaupt basically swore that he was going to be able to revive his order in some other form, and the order did manage to survive in many places outside of Germany. And ultimately, there's plenty of evidence that shows that the Illuminati were effectively responsible for the French Revolution of 1789. But there's
Actually,
enough.
that's a big assumption to make there. Can you give us an idea of what the connection is between this German occult group, a secret society that was allegedly really extinguished by the German authorities? And then the French Revolution, which was an enormous. I mean, most people see that as a spontaneous reaction to the excesses of the French royalty.
I mean, we have to understand that the French Revolution, there's two important revolutions in modern times. So, we have to understand the era that we're living in. We're still living in basically the tail end of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment, of course, was the period of the 18th century that was marked by a flourishing, I guess you could call it, of European philosophy, heavily localized in France. And in particular, targeted especially at religion. So, basically the world that we live in today is a world that was shaped during the Enlightenment, and that is so. Almost the entirety of the well-known philosophers of the time, beginning with Voltaire in particular, were members of Freemasonry. Many of them, in fact, were also members of the Illuminati. We have to remember, the thing is, the Illuminati is the name that's chosen to, has become popularized to refer to the, top level of the conspirators. But the reality is that there was many other organizations, and that Illuminati was one of many, maybe not the most important. There were already developing branches of Freemasonry. Also very influential was Martinism. In fact, I would argue that Martinism was probably more important and influential than the Illuminati, because the Martinist orders are the ones that did survive, and serve, and the leading actors, occult actors in the world today, do trace their heritage, in particular, to the Martinist orders. So, about the specific details about the role of the Illuminati. There's plenty of evidence that was already provided. There's John Robison's book, Proofs of Conspiracy, which is a good start, but far better is Barrel's book, a French historian. I think it's a multi-volume book with extensive detail. It's far too much for me to even begin to summarize. I'm just, you know, it's it's a well-documented history, and it just, it's a proof to the extent of the manipulation of history in modern times, to what extent that idea can be sort of downplayed as being just a conspiracy theory.
I suppose if you're able to make something happen, something as big as the French Revolution, and actually put out a very effective cover story, then that cover story is reinforced throughout history. It's very unlikely that people are going to get to the bottom of what really happened. But, you know, you're talking a lot here about the occult. I mean, people sometimes link this, and I think quite rightly, with mysticism. Yeah. Can you just explain what those two words mean and separate the two?
There isn't really a separation. So, you know, the occult is basically a word that's used by Western academics to refer to a particular Western mystical tradition. So, you know, there's been even arguments of whether you can make such a distinction, but there's a particular trajectory. So, because mysticism is it's its own path. There are difficulties in describing exactly what it means, but it usually means some kind of, you know, experience of the divine or the spiritual, direct experience with the divine and spiritual. And so the occult is basically, you know, that collection of societies and teachings that have sought mystical experiences. And so there's a particular history that's associated with the West. It overlaps in many ways, often, especially with the mystical traditions of the Middle East and sometimes of the Far East. But the one that is prevalent here in the West is the Western version. So for that, basically, you have to go back. Tracing backwards, you have modern movements like the New Age movement that stemmed out of the Theosophical movement. Founded by Elena Blavatsky at the turn of the century. I also mentioned the Martinists. These are all groups that emerged out of the early 18th century, as did the Freemasons. The Freemasons themselves originated with the Rosicrucians. The Rosicrucians, like the Freemasons, in many ways traced their descent to the Templars. And the legend of the Templars is that basically they preserved a hermetic tradition, or tradition of hermeticism, which is supposed to be an ancient Egyptian mystical tradition that survived since the early years of the first millennium. So that's basically a combination of hermeticism, of astrology, of Gnosticism, and I guess you could consider some influences of Sufism. That's all sort of cross-influenced each other to contribute to the Western esoteric tradition.
Well, I suppose us Brits, we tend to look with a certain amount of admiration on the Phoenicians, you know, as a former big naval empire power. I mean, the British Royal Navy, they kind of sailed around the world. They'd stick their ships off of the coast of some country, and they'd shell people until they kind of did what they said. It was a very you know, kind of bullying thing. But the Phoenicians were similar in the way that they, you know, used trade as a way to get their talons into a lot of the, say, the spiritual life, for example, of one of the countries they were dealing with. The British, of course, did that as much as they could with China and the Opium Wars, things like this. So where do the Phoenicians fit into this tradition? Because you were talking about, you know, the Dying God book, looking at tracing this right back. The Phoenicians seem to me to be quite an important force in history.
Yes, exactly. So there's two important sort of nodes in this history. So there's the ancient tradition of the Dying God, and then there is the 6th century BC, when that Dying God tradition was appropriated, I guess you could say, by the Magi of Babylon, and that incepted the beginnings of the Kabbalah, which is really, as I mentioned to you earlier, is where it all started. So that's really the origin of the Western occult tradition. So there's two ways of looking at it. There's the legendary aspect, and then there's the truly historical aspect. And so if you look, there's some sort of semi-historical and some more fanciful versions of this story. But basically the idea is that because the Bible talks about the sons of God. Before the flood, the sons of God came and basically interbred with the daughters of men and created, or the Elohim is what they're referred to in the Bible. And so it's translated in English as the sons of God. And they produced a race called the Anakim. And so the Anakim were responsible for all kinds of violence and corruption on the earth, which led to God commanding the flood. And so modern interpretations of this have taken that to refer to the creation of the Aryan race on Atlantis. But that's another tangent, but just to give you an idea of where that goes. So what happens is that the flood destroys corrupt humanity, but then you get survival of the sons of Anak, as they're referred to in the Bible. And so the story is that when Moses liberates the Israelites from Egypt, he brings them back to the promised land, the land that was promised to Abraham, which is part of the basis of the covenant. And when they enter Israel, they are commanded to conquer the land of the Canaanites and a lot of their affiliated peoples like the Amorites and so on and so forth. And so the Israelites are apparently afraid because these people are, you know, basically frightful. And they're described as the sons of Anak. So it's basically to say that the Canaanites were descendants of the Anakim. So they were descendants of the Elohim and basically these sons of God who are, and there's no interpretation offered about what that means. It's only with the Book of Enoch, which doesn't appear until the first centuries BC. And I think it's BC, which describes the sons of God or the Elohim as being the fallen angels. And these fallen angels apparently not only interbred with human beings, but that's where they learned what was later called the ancient wisdom. So they carved them all kinds of forms of magic.
Okay, so what you're implying here is that these guys survived the flood.
So I'm not implying anything. I'm just telling you what legends are believed.
Okay, so yeah, right.
So this is the story to account of how the occult tradition was introduced to humanity, to attribute it ultimately to the fallen angels. So this is the occult interpretation of history. The reality is, so first of all, is that when the Jews, the Israelites were returned to the promised land, another part of their requirements was that they were forbidden to worship the gods of the Canaanites. And those gods were mainly two. It was Baal and his wife, sister, spouse, Astarte. And ultimately, they were part of a trinity that consisted of El, the father god, and his wife, his spouse, which was the goddess Astarte, and their son was Baal. So Baal was at the same time, he also had a relationship with his, effectively what would be his mother and his sister at the same time. And so this trinity, basically, the Baal represented the sun, S-U-N, and Astarte represented the planet Venus. And those two were always considered to be close together because the sun, the Venus is the first planet to appear at sunrise. And this is why, in mystical tradition, they're always closely affiliated. And so the Latin name for Venus is Lucifer. So what you find is basically this Baal and Astarte were effectively a kind of like a single androgynous deity. And what a lot of critics of Christianity like to claim is that he was false, like most of the pagan gods, supposedly falsely described as an evil god by his Christian critics. The reality is that academics will tell you that there is such a thing as what's called a chtonic deity, and that's a god that is typically associated with underworld. So in most of the Middle East, you'll find these gods. You have gods that are often associated with, as I said, the underworld, and they're typically treated as evil gods. So Baal was such a chtonic deity. He was believed to preside over the underworld and the spirits that lived there. So the concept there is that he was the lord of the spirit, of the spirits, essentially, or, you know, demonic entities, whatever you want to call them, who were believed to be the souls of departed people. So this is how this idea of ghosts has survived in our culture. And that's how the idea of hell came to be associated with being a realm below the earth, because originally, this dying god, as we refer to, was always associated with the underworld. And so do you find that this one dying god, there's many versions of it throughout the Middle East, and there's variations on the story, but typically the story is the same. And it's usually default, basically, as the sun, he was believed to be born in December 25th and to die in winter and to resurrect in the spring, because basically he was worshipped as a fertility deity who was responsible for the life cycle of nature and the cultivation cycle. So this is why typically, because he was associated with fertility, he was usually represented with a phallus. And so this is how in his Egyptian version, he was represented, he was Osiris, and he was typically represented with an obelisk. And what else can I tell you? So basically, this, so the fundamental rituals that were associated with it. So again, there were magical rituals that were performed in the worship of Baal. And these are called apotropaic. It's a kind of magic. It's called apotropaic magic. And what that means is it's a kind of magic that's, its intent is to repel evil. So the idea is, in the simple dualism of these, you know, early peoples, was that you had good gods, and for good gods, you do good things, and you have bad gods, these chtonic deities, and for them, you have to do bad things. You have to do bad things for them because that's what they're asking for. If you don't do what they ask, they might do something bad against you, or if you make them happy, they could do something mean to your enemies. So typically what was involved in these rituals was, this is what's referred to in the episode of the golden calf in the Bible. So the golden calf, academics tend to identify the golden calf with the Apis bull. And the Apis bull is associated with Osiris. And, you know, it's very common throughout the Middle East that the dying god is usually associated with some kind of horned animal, most often some kind of cow, and often a goat. So the Bible talks that when Moses was up on the mount receiving the Ten Commandments, the Israelites gathered their jewelry and formed this idol that they worship in the form of pagan revelry, as it's described. And the what's implied there is that there's what's usually associated with these rituals is that there's some kind of intake of intoxicants. And then there's dancing and loud music. And then unfortunately, what was commonly practiced was the slaughter of an infant child, which again is a form of apotropaic magic because, you know, the most evil act you could do is to kill an innocent baby. So this.
Sorry to interrupt you, but there is a tremendous amount of evidence now that the Phoenicians were well into this. That this
exactly
they were doing this child sacrifice. In fact, that they would mingle bones of sacrificed animals with bones of sacrificed children, yes. And so, you know, as traders, they obviously tried to keep a lot of this stuff secret from the people they were trading with, but they had a most definite child sacrifice cult as part of their culture.
Absolutely. So the it's referred to in the Bible as the passing the children through the fire of Moloch. So Moloch is effectively another name for Baal. and he's identified with Saturn. And that's why the early Babylonian festivals were dedicated to Saturn. They're called, I think, the Zagmuk festivals. It was a 12-day festival. And so what happens, I'm going to give you one other tangent here before we come back, but just to say where this goes. But basically, that Babylonian festival became, what was involved is that it was a 12-day festival, a revelry where the roles were reversed. And so that the servants would take on the roles of the masters, and the masters would take on the roles of the servants, and was kind of, you know, a playful interchange where the, you know, the servants could joke around and give their masters all kinds of ridiculous tasks to perform and things like that. It was supposed to be, you know, a festival, but what it was supposed to end in was the killing of the king. And so this James Frazer is the one who's explored this in the most detail, as far as I know. And this is where, because the king is the living embodiment of the sun god or the dying god. And so if ever he becomes frail, there was believed to have been a danger that, you know, the life of the crops could be threatened. So he had to be replaced. So so usually he was killed to be replaced by, you know, a more virile successor. And what James Frazer suggests is that these early this early Saturn festival was designed to, because what would happen is that king of fools would be elected as the king of sort of, you know, this swapped reverse relationship, and then he would be slaughtered instead of the king at the end. So what happens again of this 12-day celebration in Roman times became the Saturnalia. And then that Saturnalia evolved in two directions. It evolved into the Mardi Gras festivals and carnivals around the world, and as well as Christmas, which then as well appropriated the date of December 25th as the birth of Jesus, when, of course, it's not known what day he was born on. So back to the Phoenicians. What happens is, as I said, so this is the cult that the Jews were told to stay away from, but they did the opposite. They completely immersed themselves into it. And so what happens is that the story of the Bible, basically from the Exodus of Egypt down to the Babylonian captivity in the 6th century, so a period of maybe 800 to 1,000 years, was a period of constant lapsing of the Israelites. It became basically they had veered away so far away from their actual Jewish religion to this pagan cult that even the temple itself, the Temple of Solomon, was polluted with the various elements of the pagan cult. And so effectively what I argue is that the Jews, the Israelites, sorry to say, would have been indistinguishable from the people around them because, you know, in terms of culture and ritual practice, it would have been identical to that of the Canaanites. That's why when you look at the descriptions by Herodotus of the Phoenicians, he describes them as being descendants of a colony from Egypt and of practicing circumcision. So what's interesting is, as you say, these Phoenicians now commanded the sea, and then they're the ones who are largely responsible for the beginning of the spread of these. Where they went, they spread these ritual practices. And one of the most important places where they had a profound influence was in ancient Greece. And this is why, you know, even the alphabet itself is of a Phoenician origin. You know, this is why the word alphabet comes from the three first letters of the Semitic alphabet. And there's a couple of books who are excellent on this subject. So, you know, I recommend two scholars who are, as far as I understand, probably the leading scholars of ancient Greek history. There's Walter Burkert and there's M.L. West. Walter Burkert wrote, I can't remember the title of his book, but M.L. West wrote what's called The East Face of Helicon. And they study in depth the extent of Phoenician and what they call West Semitic influence in ancient Greece. So this is where you have these two periods in Greece, which are really important because this is how this period had this Greece had such a profound influence as the so-called birthplace of Western civilization, when in reality, it's the birthplace of the Western occult tradition. So you have this initial period of what's called the Archaic period of ancient Greece, which is dominated by Phoenician influence. And this is where now you get the influx of various foreign influences. And one very important one is the worship of Dionysus. So now to get back to the story of the Israelites, what happens is that they repeatedly lapse into the worship, this dying god worship of killing their children and practicing, necromancy or communion with spirits, magic and astrology, all the things that they're forbidden to do. And so there's repeated warnings that if they persist, they're going to be punished for it. So what happens is that the Israelites were divided into two kingdoms. You had the kingdom of Israel in the north and the kingdom of Judah in the south. So the Assyrians were the first to come in the early 700s, and they took the entire people of the northern kingdom of Israel into captivity, and they dispersed them into the land of the Medes, and that's where these 10 tribes then became lost. Of the remaining king of Judah, they were finally conquered by the Babylonians, and I think the year was 596 BC. And the majority of the population was then brought to Babylon. And so this is the key of where this story begins of the Magi.
Let's just make it clear. We have all these Christmas carols and things about the three kings.
Yes.
Actually, there's no kings mentioned in the New Testament. The kings are talked, or the three kings are the three wise men, talked about quite a lot in Matthew, actually. There's your basic, they come and have a chat with Herod. Herod wants to know what they're up to. And they tell him, oh, well, we think that this new king is going to be born, at which point he raises his eyebrows and orders them to be followed, although we're not quite sure whether he did manage to follow them. Yeah. And then when they actually follow the star and find Mary and Joseph with little Jesus in his manger, they then have a dream which says, no, actually, don't go and tell Herod where you are. And they go back by another route. So I think it's just nice to make clear who these Magi are, that they're not actually there as kings in the Bible. Maybe you could start, David, by, making out, describing what you think they were. What does Magi mean? Because that's what they're described as in Matthew.
So this is the whole point, and this is the whole basis of occult history. So the funny thing is that they are not really discussed in mainstream history. So I'm going to read to you two paragraphs from Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma that was published, and I'm not sure, maybe the 1850s, approximately middle of the 18th century, to show you how this occult version, this occult interpretation or understanding of the Magi is fundamental to the history of Freemasonry in particular and the occult in general. So he says, to quote, "The occult science of the ancient Magi was concealed under the shadows of the ancient mysteries. It was imperfectly revealed, or rather disfigured, by the Gnostics. It is guessed at under the obscurities that cover the pretended crimes of the Templars, and it is found enveloped in enigmas that seem impenetrable, the rites of the highest masonry. Magism was the science of Abraham and Orpheus, of Confucius, of Zoroaster. It was the dogmas of this science that were engraven on the tables of stone by Enoch and Trismegistus. Moses purified and reveiled them, for that is the meaning of the term reveal. He covered them with a new veil. When he made the holy Kabbalah the exclusive heritage of the people of Israel and the inviolable secret of its priests. The mysteries of Thebes and Eleusis, preserved among the nations some symbols of it, already altered, and the mysterious key whereof was lost among the instruments of an ever-growing superstition. Jerusalem, the murderess of her prophets, and so often prostituted to the false gods of the Syrians and Babylonians, had at length its turn lost the holy word, when a prophet announced by the Magi, by the consecrated star of initiation," which is Sirius, "came to rend asunder the worn veil of the old temple, in order to give the church a new tissue of legends and symbols, that still and ever conceal from the profane and ever preserves to the elect of the same truths. So the key with the Magi is that they were a Babylonian priesthood. And so conventionally, it's understood to refer to the priests of the Persian religion of Zoroastrianism. There was also at the same time another cult priesthood that were known as Chaldeans, and this was the Babylonian priesthood. So again, there's so much focus on Greek history and so little, the birthplace of so much of this tradition, that this history escapes most people. So the Chaldean Magi, as they were called, were famous throughout the world as a sort of wise men. So there's one book which is really important, has been really important for me, which is written by Frantz Cumont. He's a Belgian scholar, and I've said this many times before that he's, in my opinion, the greatest academic, at least for ancient history, of the 20th century. And what makes him so skilled is that you get a lot of academics these days that focus really on one path of history. And what made him unique is that he was very well versed not only in Greek history, but also in Babylonian and Egyptian history. So he was able to trace the parallels that others missed. So the important key here of what Cumont demonstrated is that, first of all, you have to start with this notion that the Magi were priests of the religion of Zoroaster, or what's called Zoroastrianism. It's a Persian religion. It's well known for having two gods, Ahura Mazda and Ahriman. Sorry if I pronounced that badly. Who basically were in eternal cosmic conflict. And so what Cumont points out is that the Magi that became famous throughout the world practice a number of doctrines and beliefs that had nothing to do with Orthodox Zoroastrianism. There's another book by R.C. Zahner as well too, about called Zurbanism, which is another book which explains this diversion. So, in fact, Zahner explains that these Magi, the ones who became popular, because our word magic comes from Magi. He explains that they were actually Deva worshippers. So they were, Devas was in Persian culture, that was the name for demons effectively. So effectively they were demon worshippers. They were worshippers of Ahriman, the evil god. So basically what was happening is that there was a number of books that were circulating in the ancient world that were falsely attributed to Zoroaster, not only to him, but also his disciple and his patron. So one to Zosimus and the other one to Hystaspes. So there's no survival of these books, but there's elements of it that survived in other people's books. And that's how Cumont was able to sort of partially reconstruct what have been beliefs of the Magi. So fundamentally what you see is that they worship some kind of dying god. In their case, it was Mithras or Mithra, which is basically the Persian version of Baal, and a version of the goddess. I think her name was Anahita, which is the origin of Athena. And they would have practiced, believed in astrology, numerology. They believed in reincarnation and vegetarianism. So now again, back to Greece. So this is where it's important, is that in Greece, we already have a sort of a bedrock of this dying god tradition that was existing there through the survival of various, the worship of Dionysus and various other versions. And so what happens is that in the year, I think it's 538, Cyrus conquers Babylon from the Babylonians, and he releases the Jews from captivity. What happens at this point is that the majority of them are allowed to return to Israel and to rebuild the temple. But they don't all return there. Some of them go to Egypt, and some of them end up in Greece. Because what's important here is that the Persian Empire conquered the entire area of what is today Turkey. And so on the very westernmost part of Turkey was a region called, a Greek-speaking region called Ionia. And it's well known that the first beginnings of Greek philosophy began there. And again, what historians don't tell you is that those philosophers emerge under Persian occupation, even though they're referred to as Greek. And so when you look at, if you look at the pre-Socratics, the earliest Greek philosophers, their ideas all hold elements that are similar to the Magian cult. And in particular, you can read Heraclitus, and he says, what's very interesting, he gives one of the most damning pieces of evidence, and this comes from the 5th century BC, and he says himself, I can't remember, I'll have to paraphrase it, but he says that the cult of Dionysus was borrowed from the Magi, and that's an infernal cult dedicated to the phallus. So the cult of Dionysus was key because it was the earliest form of the ancient mysteries in ancient Greece. So again, this was the same dying god ritual that involved intoxication, dancing, and orgies and human sacrifice. And so from the cult of Dionysus, you get the cult of Orpheus. And there's all kinds of legends here. I can't remember. I'm not going to go into all the details, but I'll tell you that Orpheus was identified with a teacher or the same name or whatever of a man called Musaeus. And if you look at the ancient writings, Musaeus was usually identified with Moses. And so now at this time, you'll find that there's numerous claims that the earliest Greek philosophers derived their teachings from the Jews, from the Magi, and sometimes from the Jews. So in particular, there's Aristobulus, who is a Jewish historian of the 3rd century BC, and he specifically claims that Plato derived his knowledge from the Jews. So effectively, what you're looking at here is that the Greek philosophy, here's where I recommend a book by F.M. Cornford called From Religion to Philosophy, which talks about this period of Magian influence in ancient Greece. Because what's important is that a significant transformation happens here, as it happens in many parts of the world. This is also the 6th century, which is often referred to by scholars as the Axial Age, because there was so much in the transformation of world religions and ideas that took place in that century. So what you have is you have this archaic, more ancient religious tradition in Greece, which was dedicated to the worship of Dionysus and these other gods, which now gets supplanted by this new cult, especially the cult of Dionysus, but also the advent of Greek philosophy. And so that has been taken in our time by Enlightenment philosophers to suggest that the Greeks, because the Enlightenment was the so-called age of reason, so they were trying to see history as an evolution of reason, which is why they suggested that the Greeks were rejecting religion in favor of reason, and they were abandoning superstition in favor of empirical thought. The reality is that the Greek philosophers were actually adopting a new religion, and that religion was the Magian cult. And that's why when you look at the fundamental teachings of the earliest philosophers, particularly Pythagoras and Plato, you can see that it was derived from Magian teachings. And this is the way that they were viewed ever since. And this is why throughout history, Plato has always been viewed as one of the major founding figures of the Kabbalah by Jewish Kabbalists. And this is why now you can see why Albert Pike will claim this heritage for the Magi. So what happens now, in short, to tell you how this finishes, is basically this Magian cult is basically early Jewish Kabbalists who were, because the world at the time did not know who Jews were, so they basically confused them as Persians or Babylonians. And so this cult then spread more and more, especially with Greek influence. When Alexander the Great conquered much of the world, that's when this Greek version of the Kabbalah then was infiltrated to various parts of the world, most importantly, the city of Alexandria. And this really, Alexandria is really effectively what we can regard as the beginnings of the occult tradition, because this is where now you have this whole confluence of all these different versions. So now you have in Alexandria, you have the influence of the Persian occult tradition, the Egyptian occult tradition, which is known as Hermeticism. You have the influence of the various ancient mysteries, so the mysteries of Mithras, the mysteries of Sibyl, the mysteries of Isis, the mysteries of Osiris, were all basically just variations of the ancient dying god mysteries. And then you have the influence of Gnosticism, which is a, let me step back. Then you also have the influence of the Jewish mysticism, which is evidenced in groups like the Essenes and another group affiliated with them in Egypt, in Alexandria in particular, called the Therapeutae. And then you have the Greek influence, which is called Neoplatonism, and that's how it enters the fold. And then you have Gnosticism. Gnosticism is basically the Christian version of all these various cults. But the thing is that scholars refer to this era as an era of syncretism, because there are so many, what they thought were separate elements cross-pollinating each other, without understanding that they all had a single origin in the cult of the Magi. And they were just basically branches of the same cult. So Hermeticism was the alchemical sort of practical magic branch of this occultism. Neoplatonism was the theology, and the ancient mysteries were the rituals.
So can you sum up what the, most people aren't really familiar with Zoroastrianism. What did the Magi actually believe? What was at the core of their, religion?
I mean, that's exactly what I explained. So you probably had Magi who were actually legitimate Orthodox priests of the religion of Zoroastrianism. And then you had these quote-unquote heretical Magi who became popular throughout the ancient world. And for them, we don't have, any concrete survival of what they wrote or left behind. It's a belief system that has to be reconstructed. So it's a lot of circumstantial evidence, enough circumstantial evidence to make a case, but it's not clear. You get a better understanding of what they believed out of the belief systems that were constructed from what they supposedly left behind. So we get a better idea from, like, to give you an example, the one belief that holds all of these, that's shared with all of the groups in the syncretism in Alexandria, so between Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, and Gnosticism, is the belief of the, and what in the Jewish version was called Merkabah mysticism. And Merkabah mysticism, which is what Gershom Scholem called Jewish Gnosticism, and he characterized as the origin of the Jewish Kabbalah. So the fundamental belief is that there are seven heavenly planets, or seven heavenly gods associated with each of the planets, and each associated with a metal. So you have sort of like a spectrum from the sun to Saturn, and Saturn is lead and the sun is gold. And so it's kind of an alchemical process where the mystic has to proceed through the seven planets, and he has to use the magical words to pass sort of the trials. If you want to know, some of this is referred to in the movie the Ghostbusters, and anybody interested to understand how this works. So you pronounce these what are called words of power, or magical words to proceed. So you proceed through the seven planets, so basically transforming yourself from lead to gold when you reach, because the sun is, the gold is symbolized by the sun, and then that's where you have union with the sun. In Merkabah mysticism, the sun is a god who is described in the book of Ezekiel as in his chariot. And this is where the symbol is essential, because the chariot, God is apparently sitting on a chariot held by four creatures. And these creatures have four heads, and they're standing on a wheel inside a wheel. The wheel inside a wheel refers to the two equators. So there's the two orbits. So you have the orbit of the Earth on itself and the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. So this is why these two circles were important. This is how this is what was referred to in Plato's literature as the Greek letter chi, which looks like an X, and that's one of the ways that the cross came to be adopted in Christianity. So the four creatures again have four heads. This is the head of a lion, the head of an eagle, of a man, and a bull. And what those represent is the four sectors, the four seasons of the zodiac, each represented by a different sign. So the bull is Taurus, the eagle is Scorpio, the man is Aquarius, and the lion is Leo. And of course, so this four creatures, this is a concept that was taken from the chariot god. So if you look in ancient Egypt, god Ra was pulled by a chariot led by four horses. It's the same with Apollo. And there's another important Greek myth. His name is I forgot, but it's another myth of a chariot, which is all related to the mysteries, to the ancient mysteries. And this is why when you look in the book of Revelation, these creatures then appear again.
Why does this matter today still?
Why it matters today is because when we talked about the Illuminati, I just read you the quote from Albert Pike. He explained that, you know, this so-called heritage of the Magi is the rites of the highest Freemasonry. So, because what's that referring to is the development of the cult of the Magi is in actuality the development of the Jewish Kabbalah. What happens is that when the Jews are in Babylon, basically that captivity was supposed to have been a punishment that they sort of recognized. Well, they should have recognized it as a punishment for their errors, but instead you have this group. I don't think it was the entire population who chose to reinterpret in a mystical fashion the significance of the captivity. So they instead of recognizing that, you know, the captivity is a punishment for their worship of the dying god, they retained the worship of the dying god, and they assimilated it with the magical practices that they learned in Babylon, particularly Babylonian astrology and numerology. So this combination of these two traditions is basically what created the, it's the birth of this particular tradition of magic, satanic magic, if I might say, which manifested itself in Judaism as Kabbalah, and again manifested itself in Greece as philosophy. So when you look at the birth of this thing, of this cult, this is it. Everything that you can describe from that point forward is derived from there. So the people, the cultists who are operating today, you know, as part of effectively what's a Luciferian conspiracy, they are operating on this belief that they are, perpetuating the cult of the ancient magi, this cult of magic, which they believe is their means for bringing about. And again, it comes back to the revelation, because, you know, we've talked about this before, that, you know, there's the effectively modern occultists are Gnostic. So just because they worship Lucifer as a true god doesn't mean that they reject the Bible. No, they believe in the same Bible and read the same Bible that the Christians do, except they interpret it in reverse. So they put just as much or maybe even more significance on the book Revelation, because to them it presents the blueprint that they need to follow in order to bring about the end times. And the means for achieving that end is magic.
So you mentioned James Frazer there. He talks a lot about, there's others that do a lot of this linking back, the Margaret Murray and her book, which is The God of the Witches, another one the witch cult in Western Europe. What they do is they trace back into not so, you know, make back into medieval and before that, but yeah. They're looking particularly at Christmas as the big pagan festival of the year, the fire yeah. festival, and really nothing to do with Christianity at all.
No, yeah, it doesn't. If you look at the history of Christmas, it's very interesting. So I got a chapter in my book in volume 2. So the Saturnalia survived as two traditions in the West. You have the Mardi Gras festivals, you have the Feast of Fools. And so what's the thing is that Christmas was many times banned in Europe. One of the times, one of the most important periods when it was revived was with Francis Bacon. And this is Francis Bacon, a.k.a. William Shakespeare. So they used to perform Christmas festivals at what are called the Inns of Court. And the Inns of Court were originally founded by the Templars. And it's a sort of like a festival that basically it's a survival of the Feast of Fools, and it involves what's called the Lord of Misrule. And so the Lord of Misrule is basically Lucifer. And this is why it's a period of turning everything upside down. And so this is how, you know, a cult tradition tried to hide itself within Christianity, disguise itself, basically, by giving itself a cover of being a Christian festival by appropriating, by claiming that it was a celebration of the worship of Jesus. But I'm pretty sure that the practitioners knew very well what they were doing. And what you have now is that in Puritan England, I'm not sure how long it was, maybe a couple hundred years, Christmas was actually banned. And then you get various people who are involved in trying to revive it. And I can't remember the personalities exactly, but they're basically Santa. So obviously Santa has nothing to do with Jesus, right? Santa is not in any way, well, he's remotely related to, he's supposedly Saint Nicholas, but he's effectively the god Saturn, of the god of Saturnalia. And so what's interesting is he's often referred to as jolly old Saint Nick, and old Nick is another word for Satan. The people who are responsible for reviving, stimulating the repopularization of Christianity were typically people who were associated with the cult and Satanism. Like I give you an example, unfortunately, a person like Charles Dickens, who was a friend of people like Edward Bulwer Lytton, who was really the chief Satanist of the 18th century. And then I can't remember the details, unfortunately, that are all in my chapter. But it's basically that circle of people. Just to give you an idea, it's really interesting because there's a period of in the mid 18th century that's called Romantic Satanism, and it's a group of people who are all inspired by Milton's Paradise Lost. So the key people there were William Blake. Who was influenced by Swedenborg, belonged to the Swedenborg societies, their whole, a lot of literature there done by Margaret Shouchard, which is fascinating. And then you have William Godwin. William Godwin is considered the founder of philosophical anarchism. You have his wife, Mary Wollstonecraft, who is the founder of one of the founders of feminism. I've got a great article that I reference in my book that basically describes her as a female Illuminati. They were all friends with a group. They were all connected to a group. I think there's called the Johnson Circle. Friends with people like Michael Payne. Was it Michael Payne? What's the name of the American Revolutionary author?
I think Thomas? His name.
Thomas Paine, thank you. Thomas Paine, and who was as well listed as a member of the Illuminati. So these are all people who basically, you know, were effectively Satanists. And so this circle also included two authors, two members of the Skull and Bones, who were responsible for the fabrication of the flat earth myth. So, you know, the idea has been popularized. It's almost taken as standard history that people in Columbus's time thought the Earth was flat. Nothing could be further from the truth. It had long been known since the, you know, a few centuries BC that the Earth was round, global, a globe. And but they were trying to create what was called the conflict thesis. So this is typical of the period where they're trying, because this is how now you connect this group to the Lunar Society that connects Charles Darwin, Thomas Huxley, Galton, because this was their way. And of course, stemming from the Royal Society, which was a Rosicrucian society. And their goal was to use science and to create the argument, the perception that science was in conflict with religion. So they invented various, you know, myths of history. And one of those that they invented was the story about the supposed belief that the Earth was flat in Columbus's time. This story was first, if I'm getting the story correct, written by John William Draper. And so I think it's, if I remember correctly, it's from him that we get the contributing to the revival. No, it's not him. Contributed to the revival of Satan. So you get people like, I think he's connected people like Nathaniel Hawthorne. Nathaniel Hawthorne is another one, because he's another one who sort of revived the popularity of the Feast of Fools, or the you know, like the Maypole ceremonies and those kinds of things. So yeah, anyway, so they sent that entire group. So they were the ones who were really popularizing, of course, Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. And this is from that point forward that you get a return of the celebrations of Christmas, and ultimately, you know, basically to where we are today.
Well, it's interesting. I noticed that the Greek Orthodox Patriarch this Christmas in December 2022 has been saying what many, Christian leaders have said over the centuries, which is, everything at Christmas seems to be focusing on people spending as much money as possible, right, and acquiring goods or services, but particularly physical things, rather than seeing it as a spiritual festival anymore. But, you know, I wonder, David, if it's just simply a bit of clever deviousness by the original Christians trying to encompass the fire festival in winter, because of course this was actually probably the most popular part of pagan culture, right, that the people just did not want to relinquish. You know, a great party, lots of drunkenness, a bit of debauchery as well in the middle of winter, and yet you're telling them to give up this, you know, important way of actually, in a way, you know, cursing winter, saying, no, you know, we're going to have a nice hot fire and loads to drink, and we're going to really celebrate. You know, it would have been very difficult to persuade pagans to say, well, no, you're not going to do that anymore. You're just going to sit in your hut and, I don't know, have a reading of the Psalms or a mass or something instead.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. So there's two stories there. There's a story of how the worship of Sol Invictus, effectively, which is another form of Mithras, was appropriated to Christianity. So there's numerous ways that happened. You know, the problem there is that a lot of the Christian, early Christian fathers were influenced by Philo Judaeus. And he was a Jewish scholar, and he was largely responsible for attempting to marry Neoplatonism with Judaism. And so what's interesting is that Philo Judaeus is also, he's one of the primary sources for describing the worship of the Therapeutae, which were a group who were affiliated with the Essenes. So there's effectively two sources on the Essenes. There's Josephus, and there's Philo Judaeus indirectly. Just to show you that, you know, he was a devotee of the occult. And so Philo Judaeus is the one, basically, so he took the Neoplatonic Trinity, which was taken from the pagan Trinity, and he interpreted it in Judaism. And this is where he came up with the idea of, he thought that I think it would have been the Logos, identified it with the first begotten of God. And so the early Christian fathers, people like Justin Martyr, they, following the example of Philo Judaeus, they wanted to adapt Neoplatonism to Christianity. And that's how a lot of these ideas were incorporated in Christianity. And part of that involved, this is why there were numerous accusations from very early on about the various elements of Christianity being borrowed from the mysteries, most notably the Eucharist. So eating the flesh and the blood of the God was supposedly adopted from the mysteries, the Mithraic mysteries in particular. And of course, so Mithras or Sol Invictus is his other aspect, who was supposedly born on December 25th. So that's how that idea was infiltrated in Christianity. But then what happens over the years is that you have people, I mean, we have to understand, this is why we live in a very different time, where we live in a time when the occultists have seized power. So they no longer have to hide like they used to. They still have to hide to a degree because Satanism is still not popular. But when the Christian church was in power, it was a totally different story. They would be burned at the stake for going public with any of their practice. So they always had to disguise themselves. So they find numerous ways to do that. So as like I mentioned, you know, practicing the Feast of Fools would have been one. And Christmas would have been another. And so these would have been people who were consciously Satanists, who knew that they were disguising their practices to keep it hidden or at least muffled. And so I think what's happening in our time is that, this is why the Satanists of the 18th century, they're the ones who are responsible for reviving the Festival of Christmas, and effectively promoting this figure of Santa at the expense of Jesus. So now today we have two simultaneous festivals. You have got Santa and you've got Jesus. So some Christians will celebrate it as a Christian festival celebrating the birth of Jesus, when the sort of the popular, the layman, the lay culture effectively is not looking at it as a Christian festival at all, but more of a cultural tradition, which involves this figure of Santa without recognizing its origin. Because we have to remember that, this is like this is the four seasons of the zodiac. This is why this is the four creatures of the chariot of Ezekiel. The four seasons. That's why there's four festivals that throughout the year, which are the most important satanic festivals, and that's Easter, St. John's Day, which is the summer solstice, Halloween, which is the fall equinox, and Christmas, which is the winter equinox. So I think effectively what's happening
the
is
winter,
that...
You mean the winter solstice? You mean the solstices and the equinoxes, yeah.
So I think what's happening now is you have this subversion of of this opportunity effectively to inject this satanic culture onto the society unwittingly.
Well, yes. I think also it would be a good idea to look a little bit at Aleister Crowley, because he's somebody who everybody kind of knows in the UK. They're not quite sure how he fits into all of this as a Satanist. I remember reading that I think it was 1938, he was invited to speak at Oxford University to the Poetry Society, and the vice principal got wind of this at the university and so sent him a polite letter, which I think was copied to the Guardian at the time, saying, well, actually, no, you're a Satanist. We don't really want Satanists coming and speaking at the University Poetry Society. Yeah. And they addressed that to him in Kent. And the one of the local websites near where I was brought up talked about Crowley as studying Freemasonry in Locke's Bottom in Kent, which is also the site of the US Ambassador's House on a private gated estate, Keston Park there. Which actually also had on its eastern the road up to Biggin Hill, which is, I mean, I know we're getting a bit obscure here, but there was a satanic sign on the outside of the estate, you know, just next to the road entrance in and out of it, which is also gated. Anyway, so this is the area where, as a school child, I used to mess around with Nick Land, and in the same on Keston Common and Hayes Common. And I just wonder if you could say something about Land, because he, you know, he's a very interesting guy to be at school with. And he is also, as you've said, talked in a, he's done this treatise called The Dark Enlightenment. We were talking about the other enlightenment, the, you know, much more recent one earlier on. And I just wonder what you make of him, because he's endorsed, as you said, this thing called the Order of the Nine Angles. So can you just tell us a little bit about the Land and the Accelerationists, the Dark Enlightenment, and then maybe... Yeah. And then maybe, you know, take a look at the Order of the Nine Angles, because they are quite definitely involved, most definitely in very serious terrorism, and yet still haven't actually been banned in the UK.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot there. I mean, so, you know, what I mentioned is that earlier is that
What I'm trying to do, David, is to show how, I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is extremely relevant today, you know, that it's not, you know, this tradition is very under the surface. As soon as you start scratching, you start to find it.
Yeah. Yeah, so just in support of what you're saying, I say that scholars like to say that the Illuminati was disbanded, but I say that probably more influential was the Order of Martinism. And so an important leader of the Martinist cult, I'm going to get, this is why I'm getting to what you're saying, was Pappas, a French occultist. And so he sort of effectively merged the traditions of Martinism and what's called Synarchism, which was founded by a guy named Saint-Yves Dalvet, the French occultist. And so most of the leading cultists of the time were affiliated with some way. An important student of Pappas would have been René Guénon. And you have, I can't remember what years, in the, I think in the 20s, the 30s, you have the formation of what's called a Fudosi, which is like a federation of synarchist and Martinist organizations. And this is where Harvey Spencer Lewis got his exercised a lot of influence. He was the founder of AMARC, the American Rosicrucian Society. And out of there, one of the leaders of this federation was Victor Blanchard, who was the founder of, he was the Grand Master of what's called the Polaire Brotherhood. And so this nexus of ideas of Synarchism, Martinism, and the Polaire is really the birth of the truly influential occult tradition. This is where you get all the ideas of the Priory of Zion that were popularized by Dan Brown. And the leaders today of this tradition, I can name two of them at least. One of them is Alexander Dugin, and the other one is his friend in France. His name is Christian Boucher, who is the head of the OTO, the French OTO, which is Aleister Crowley's organization. So So a large part of Dugin's plans is to create a conflict between what he calls Hyperborea and Agartha, Atlantis. Sorry. So he looks at the East as being the representatives of the Hyperborean tradition, and this is basically because his entire philosophy is based on the Polaire Brotherhood. And which is against Atlantis, which is represented by England and the United States. And part of that strategy involves funding and supporting right-wing groups across Europe. So much of the rise of the far right in the Europe in the last, at least the last decade, maybe 15 years or more, has been through the support and funding of Russia. So this is why now you get this proliferation of groups around the world, and how they've evolved most recently is that now we're finally starting to see examples of right-wing terrorism. And so these right-wing terrorists practice a philosophy which they refer to as accelerationism. And as you mentioned, Nick Land is one of the architects of that belief. And this is how they're connected worldwide. So, of course, Nick Land has had an influence in the West, particularly on Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is really, you know, pretty much the granddaddy of the tech community in the United States, former founder of PayPal. He's also a Bilderberger. He's the founder of Palantir, which is a CIA-backed company, who helped Cambridge Analytica breach Facebook data to in support of the Trump campaign. And so there's various groups, and this is how now we get back to the Ukraine crisis, because this is how one of the groups which is affiliated with this right-wing network would be the Azov Battalion. And this is another example of how the Ukrainian government has been funding and supporting not only right-wing extremism, but overt neo-Nazism, and which is a claim that Putin, you know, correctly makes towards him, regardless of what his intentions are. I'm not justifying his intentions. I'm just saying that he's using the truth to his advantage.
Isn't it the oligarchs which are the main funders of the Ukrainian Nazis? I thought, you know, you've got your Kolomoyskys, people like this who. Although the Ukrainian government is facilitating this, a lot of the money seems to come from these bizarrely Jewish oligarchs who have dual Israeli Ukrainian citizenship.
Yes. So, I mean, it's one and the same. This is where, you know, Putin derives his power. And this is how that network, volunteered to support the Trump campaign.
Yeah, do you want to just wind up by saying how you think best to deal with these people? You know, is there any solution to, or is it just that we've just got to understand who's pulling which strings?
Yeah. Well, to be blunt, it's a centuries-long satanic conspiracy, right? And the goal is to humiliate humanity by duping them into creating a new world order, which is effectively going to be their own prison. So humanity is being duped into building their own prison and a prison of debauchery. That's the ultimate goal and the ultimate humiliation. So the thing is, you know, like I often say, is that because, you know, occultists like to treat the truth as something that can be hidden. And they like to talk about, you know, the truth being suppressed and books being hidden, and because that's how they operate, because they operate not on wisdom but on information, because for them ultimate knowledge is magic, and magic is basically just a fraud. And true wisdom, you can't take away wisdom, because wisdom is in every man's heart, man or woman's heart. But the problem is that we are living in a world where everything, there's an apparatus in place to try to get us to deceive ourselves, to betray our conscience. So we're all born knowing what's right and wrong, but we are presented with versions of reality to induce us to, again, betray ourselves. So particularly a version of history. So this is why the whole idea of Western history is a fabrication, largely to help people, Westerners in particular, but the whole world effectively, to arrive at particular conclusions, to view the world a certain way which serves this agenda. So what has to happen is that people know deep in their hearts what's right and wrong, and they know that they know what they are doing is wrong. They know that they have deceived themselves just to follow along with everybody else, and they know that what's happening around them is wrong. The problem is that they are afraid, they feel overwhelmed. They don't see how their actions could have a consequence. And that's because they don't have belief in God, because God is the true power. What they need to recognize, they need to have more trust in themselves. They need to trust themselves to affirm deep down what they know is the truth, and to stand up for it, and to believe that they are not alone, because it's not about what they can do or any group of them can do. It's entirely they can rely on God. God is the ultimate power, no matter what these Luciferian, what kind of power these Luciferians accumulate, it will never be not even a speck compared to the enormous power that God can wield. And that's ultimately what this purpose is. We're here effectively to discover just that, to recognize that, you know, what we need to do is we need to discover the truth. So people need to read, they need to study, they need to understand what's going on, and they need to share that information to wake up other people. We need a critical mass of people. We need a number large enough to be able to oppose the agenda. And, you know, we can never be afraid of how much power they've accumulated. We have to recognize that God is waiting for us to recognize that we can only do it through Him.
So more courage, less fear, more faith.
Yes.
Okay, David Livingstone, can you just remind us where people can go and find your latest book online? And can we get a paperback copy or hardback copy of it?
You bet. Thank you, Tony. My website is ordoabcowell.ca. That's where you'll find online. So my six volumes, you'll see there's a menu at the top, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. For each from there, you'll see all the chapters of each of the volumes. So you can read the book online or from the homepage. For any page, you'll see there's links to buy my book on Amazon. So that's a paperback version or a Kindle version. And of course, Kindle doesn't need to be read on a Kindle device. You can download the app to your computer and you can read it that way as well.
Okay, David Livingstone, thanks for joining us. And a Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Same to you.